Can't understand what life's about unless you've done it. 50,000 American soldiers were sacrificed on that pagan altar in Vietnam so the crime bosses could build an empire on their bones. To lie, cheat, and steal. Simmons left Congress in 1985 after receiving awards from Casey in the Senate to become a visiting lecturer at Yale, where he taught classes titled Congress and the U.S. Intelligence Community and The Politics of Intelligence. In 1991, he was elected to Connecticut General Assembly, where he remained for 8 years. While campaigning for the Senate in 2009, Simmons said, "I am honored to have served in the U.S. Army and the CIA, putting my life on the line on difficult and dangerous missions abroad to protect our people and our interests." Some things never change, including Simmons's jingoism and self-glorification. But was he really honored to have participated in the genocide of 2 million people who never threatened the U.S.? Apparently he was. Such is the power of self-delusion, of constructing a persona and coming to believe in it so thoroughly it replaces the actual human being, like a bite from the walking dead. But do we want self-deluded ideologues whose loyalty is to the CIA and the military, not to the American public or democracy as public officials? In 2000, in my article for Counterpunch, I asked if voters could be certain Simmons would tell them everything they needed to know in order to govern themselves. How could anyone know for sure he wasn't playing a double game or hiding secrets, consistently promoting militarism and war, no matter its necessity or cost? As Simmons once said, "In intelligence, you have to lie, cheat, and steal to get the truth. The reason for it is for your national security." Unfortunately, as FBN agent Martin Pera explained, "You can't check your morality at the door, go out and lie, cheat, and steal, and then come back and retrieve it. In fact, if you're successful because you can lie, cheat, and steal, those things become tools you use in the bureaucracy." That's exactly what Simmons did while serving as a legislative aide and staff director for the Senate Intelligence Committee. I'm guessing that he was intentionally placed in that position to effectuate the secret policies of the CIA. His career illustrates how the Old Boy Network coordinates the executive, legislative, and judicial branches of government on behalf of the arms industry, to which the military and CIA are joined at the hip, while simultaneously imposing increasingly systematic repression on the American people. It is rule by organized crime under the rubric of patriotism and national security. Just figure, the CIA runs the arms for drugs trade through its covert paramilitary army, while its logistics experts handle off-the-shelf shipping companies and its financial experts create offshore banks to recycle the cash into new operations. All of it is highly compartmented, with intelligence officers suborning foreign customs agents and special policemen, some of whom arrange without their own government's knowledge the construction and operation of black sites. Simmons is naturally endowed with the persona needed for a PR position in this enterprise. He was a lector at his Episcopalian church in Tony Stonington, Connecticut, when I interviewed him. He knew I'd spoken with Colby and was glad to discuss aspects of his CIA activities that advanced the myths he was creating about himself as he prepared to re-enter the national political arena as a U.S. congressman, a career move that seemed preordained. In 2000, I also asked the overwhelming question, where in a nation sharply divided along ideological lines would a hardline political and psychological warrior like Simmons stand if the Bush administration embarked on another genocidal campaign against another manufactured enemy, like Johnson and Nixon did in Vietnam and Reagan and Bush did during Iran-Contra? Would he betray the will of the American people to live in peace as a way to reward his patrons in the CIA? Where would Simmons stand if America entered an age of dissent? His voting record speaks for itself, as Simmons is fond of saying. Claiming that intelligence is the first line of defense in the war on terrorism, he voted to allow the Bush regime to authorize electronic surveillance without a court order to acquire foreign intelligence information. He voted to allow the security services to spy on Americans without a warrant, and without going to the FISA court. He voted for intelligence gathering without civil oversight, which erodes our basic constitutional rights. He voted to declare that Iraq was part of the war on terror and to invade and occupy it forever. He voted to steal up to $78.9 billion in public funds and give it to arms manufacturers as emergency funds for the terror wars on Afghanistan and Iraq. That's $62.5 billion for military operations in Iraq and the war on terror, $4.2 billion for homeland security, $8 billion in aid to allies and for Iraqi relief and rebuilding, $3.2 billion for U.S. airlines to cover additional security costs, and $1 billion in aid to Turkey, which in turn dutifully allows CIA agents to infiltrate Syria. He voted to give more and more public money to the war machine, while more and more Americans slipped out of the middle class into poverty. He voted yes on making the Bush tax cuts permanent and was warned by the AARP not to use its name in his campaign ads. He received a grade A from the NRA and voted to continue military recruitment on college campuses. He voted yes on building a fence along the Mexican border and yes for comprehensive immigration reform without amnesty. While chairman of the Homeland Subcommittee on Intelligence, Information Sharing, and Terrorism Risk Assessment, he advocated improved intelligence coordination between federal, state, and local authorities on the Phoenix Program model. He voted to create a Phoenix-style National Intelligence Director and National Counterterrorism Center. He voted yes on making the Patriot Act permanent, yes on protecting the Pledge of Allegiance, yes on disallowing R-rated movies and coffee pots in prison cells, yes on military border patrols to battle drugs and terrorism, on allowing school prayer during the war on terror, yes on the Bush regime's national energy policy, and yes on keeping the Cuba travel ban until its political prisoners were released. Finding himself a congressperson at the most critical point in America's legislative history in the past 50 years, he was a consistent and prominent advocate for the Bush regime's extra-legal policies and practices regarding the administrative detention and torture of suspects in the war on terror. In 2006, the host of Talk Nation Radio in Connecticut, Dory Smith, interviewed Wells Dixon, an attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Dixon worked on Guantanamo-related issues. Simmons had argued that suspects in the war on terror are exceptions to the Geneva Conventions and that rules that have been used in the past do not apply to them. Smith asked Dixon if Simmons was correct. Dixon replied that Simmons was wrong. He emphasized that the Geneva Conventions and Common Article 3 are part of U.S. military law and training. They are part of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and they are also part of Army Regulation 190.8, which governs the treatment of prisoners. The Geneva Conventions, of course, have also protected our soldiers for more than 50 years and will continue to do so as long as we adhere to them fully ourselves. Simmons had also insisted that because the war on terror is not fought against sovereign nations or organized liberation movements, the rules of prisoners' engagement are non-existent. He insisted that the laws were vague, and soldiers posted at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib couldn't figure out how to treat prisoners. Simmons again was dissembling. As Dixon noted, the Supreme Court held in the Hamdan case that there was no basis for concluding that compliance with the Uniform Code of Military Justice was impractical in the war on terror. In a particularly outrageous assertion, Simmons said that conditions at Gitmo were more open than at the Osborne Correctional Facility in Connecticut. Dixon again corrected Simmons. The conditions at Guantanamo are not more open than at Osborne Correctional Facility. For one thing, there is no question that the detainees at Guantanamo have been tortured and abused by U.S. military personnel and CIA agents. The Center for Constitutional Rights has documented this in a report issued in July that provides firsthand accounts from current detainees and their lawyers of many of the abuses they have suffered while they have been detained in Guantanamo. Dixon reminded the audience that Rumsfeld approved a list of techniques, including the exploitation of phobias. One detainee was deprived of sleep for 49 out of 50 days, subject to an induced hypothermia, and led to believe that he was in Egypt and he would be tortured unless provided information to the government. Dixon said that Rumsfeld's enhanced interrogation methods rose to the level of torture. The General Counsel of the Navy, Alberto Mora, said in 2004 in a memorandum that it was his opinion that these sorts of activities would be not only unlawful, but unworthy of military service, and that in his view they would rise to the level of torture. He raised a number of rhetorical questions, such as, what does deprivation of light and auditory stimuli mean? Can a detainee be locked in a completely dark cell, and if so, for how long? A month? A year? Another question he asked was, can phobias be applied until madness sets in? If you consider the conclusions of people like Mr. Mora, I don't think that there is any credible dispute at this point that the detainees in Guantanamo have been subject to torture and abuse. Smith noted that Simmons backed legislation that would send detainees to military courts that could withhold classified evidence from suspects, which is exactly the system the U.S. imposed on South Vietnam, as Simmons knew from having sent suspects to the Stalinist security courts there. Dixon again cited the Hamdan case, saying the Supreme Court ruled there is no basis to argue that the Uniform Code of Military Justice is inadequate to try terrorism suspects. He noted that after 4 years, suspects could not possibly have any intelligence value or pose a threat to the United States. They were pawns in a public relations game. Even the CIA had concluded in a 2002 report that most of the people at Gitmo were there because they were captured at the wrong place at the wrong time. They had nothing to do with terrorism. This is a statement that's been echoed by many former military officials, including the former Guantanamo commander Jay Hood, who said, look, sometimes we just didn't get the right folks. So I think it's important to remember that. Dixon raised another troubling issue. A provision in the Military Commissions Act suspends habeas corpus for any alien detained by the United States, he said. This would include lawful immigrants picked up on the streets of New Haven or Hartford, and it therefore deprives them of any meaningful opportunity to challenge their detention. So as a result of this provision, we expect that the United States will move to dismiss a number of the pending habeas cases, and we will then challenge the law on the ground that it's an unconstitutional suspension of habeas corpus. Next, Smith raised the issue of withholding medical care from wounded prisoners, as Simmons did when he was the PIC in Vietnam. That was a violation of the Geneva Convention, wasn't it? She asked. Absolutely, Dixon replied. The denial of medical care to someone in the custody of the United States certainly would be illegal and unconscionable, and it would violate the Geneva Conventions, no question about it. Last but not least, Smith asked, do you think that he should have been more open about this when he argued for changes to U.S. law and the way we interpret the Geneva Conventions? Dixon noted that military regulations do not apply to the CIA. He then stressed that torture has proved to be extremely unreliable and, in fact, extremely dangerous. He noted that the CIA had rendered Mahar Arar to Syria, where he was tortured and then confessed. Arar, however, was innocent and eventually cleared by the Canadian government. And so I think that you can see from that example that coercion and torture really is not useful for interrogation practices, Dixon said. The other instance that I would point to, Dixon added, is the case of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, a suspected bin Laden associate who was captured a few months after September 11th in Afghanistan. He was rendered by the CIA to Libya, where he was tortured, and under torture provided information concerning the connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. This information formed the basis for Colin Powell's presentation to the United Nations in February of 2003, in which he said essentially that there was a connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. We now know that that's not the case, that the information al-Libi provided was false, and we now know what the unfortunate results are of that information, i.e. the invasion of Iraq. So to the extent that Congressman Simmons or any other interrogator would employ coercive or other means to obtain information, I would be very suspicious. Suspicious indeed. Simmons always finds a way to clear the CIA of any wrongdoing. He is, after all, clearing himself when he clears the CIA. That's what happens when a nation is ruled by a protected few, regulated only by one another. Chapter 16. Major General Bruce Lawler, from CIA officer in Vietnam to Homeland Security honcho. In August 2002, I wrote an open letter to Major General Bruce Lawler at the Office of Homeland Security. Lawler had recently been named as Homeland Security's Senior Director for Protection and Prevention. By coincidence, he was a former CIA officer whom I had interviewed at length for the Phoenix program. Given that Lawler had been involved in Phoenix operations in Vietnam, it seemed fitting that he would get a job at Homeland Security, which is modeled on Phoenix. But I was still surprised. When I met him in 1988, Lawler was a small-town lawyer in Vermont, feeling unappreciated and resentful of his former bosses at the CIA. He was still mad at the left, too. He'd run for attorney general in Vermont's 1984 Democratic primary. And in the spirit of full disclosure, he had listed his CIA service in the Phoenix program on the resume his campaign staff handed out to the press. Then the unexpected happened. A small radical magazine published a scathing article about Lawler and Phoenix. Soon thereafter, the state's anti-imperialist and pacifist groups produced briefs for delegates at the Democratic convention that said, "No assassins for Attorney General." Lawler lost the primary, even though William Colby, a native of Vermont, visited the state during the campaign to speak on Lawler's behalf. How times have changed. A decade after the Vietnam War ended, it was still possible to persuade voters that a former member of a covert torture and assassination program wasn't suitable to be a state's chief law enforcement officer. Since 9/11, it has become a badge of honor. In any event, 4 years after he lost in the primary, Lawler still held the grudge against the peaceniks who, in his opinion, had smeared him. When I wrote my open letter in 2002, I wondered exactly what he had in store for people like me, now that he was in charge of the Homeland's protection and prevention. Here we go again. Having former CIA officers in important government positions is nothing new. I refer you to the previous chapter about former Congressman Rob Simmons, who ran a torture chamber in Vietnam. Another example, Yale graduate and Bush family insider Porter Goss served in the CIA's operations division for over 10 years, attacking Cuba, handling agents in Mexico, and eventually serving in London. None of what Goss actually did is known, but he had tons of campaign money and was elected to Congress in 1988. He served the neocon cause until 2006, when Bush named him director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Goss was in Pakistan in early 2001, just prior to the 9/11 attacks, having lunch with the head of Pakistan's version of the CIA, General Mahmoud Ahmed, whose agent network had ties to Osama bin Laden and directly funded, supported, and trained the Taliban. Other slimy CIA spooks walk the halls of Congress, like William Hurd, who slithered around Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. Like Simmons and Goss, the CIA apparently greased his slide into Congress so it could more effectively repress American society the way it does foreign nations. The question needs to be asked, is having people who are in actuality war criminals in positions of legislative and executive authority in America an expression of a free society? Or is the CIA antithetical to democratic institutions, given that it is a secretive organization whose modus operandi is similar to that of an organized crime outfit and corrupts everyone it comes in contact with? Should CIA officers be disqualified from holding public office? What is to prevent them from treating their domestic enemies the same way they treat their foreign enemies? I admit it was frightening to learn that Bruce was now a major general and a top-ranking official in the ominous Office of Homeland Security. Suddenly, he had access to whatever political blacklists the Bush regime had assembled, as well as control over any covert action teams that might be used to neutralize dissidents. As a replica of the Phoenix Coordination Program, the Homeland Security apparatus is a perfect cover for all manner of clandestine blackmail and extortion operations. My fear was that Lawler was still working for the CIA, and even if not, still had that mentality, and thus posed a threat to democracy in America. One reason for that concern was that nowhere in Lawler's online biographies was there any mention of his CIA service. That omission indicated intent to deceive. The executive session on domestic preparedness, a standing task force of leading practitioners and academic specialists concerned with terrorism and emergency management, sponsored by Harvard and the Departments of Defense and Justice, posted a biography of Lawler. It mentioned that he'd been the first commanding general of the Joint Task Force, Civil Support, JTS-CS, at Fort Monroe. The JTS-CS, it explained, had been formed to provide command and control over Department of Defense consequence management forces in support of a civilian lead federal agency following a weapon of mass destruction incident in the United States, its territories, or possessions. Could that civilian lead federal agency be the CIA, I wondered? The JTF-CS's mission sounded like a self-fulfilling prophecy, in view of the fact that it was founded a mere 2 years before the 9/11 terror attacks. In its 2000 policy paper, Rebuilding America's Defenses, the neocon project for a new American century worried that the transformation of American armed forces through new technologies and operational concepts was likely to take too long, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. Many people felt this, too, was a self-fulfilling prophecy. And, of course, Lawler commanded the JTF-CS through 9/11 until October 2001, when it was merged with NORTHCOM. Nowhere in the executive session's biography did Lawler's patrons at Harvard, he's a graduate of its National Security Fellows Program, say that he had once been a CIA officer. Why not? In another biography that at one time was posted on the Internet but has since been removed, the Wikipedia link goes nowhere, Lawler was said to have been assigned as the Deputy Director Operations Readiness and Mobilization within the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Plans in May 1998. As Deputy Director, he monitors Army operations worldwide and oversees National Guard and Reserve Forces integration efforts. This is significant, too, insofar as National Guard and Reserve Forces are, like JTF-CS, integral parts of NORTHCOM, the military component of the Homeland Security apparatus. NORTHCOM was formed after 9/11 specifically to enhance the military's ability to coordinate with civilian law enforcement agencies. Since then, the military has steadily expanded its influence over domestic law enforcement, with eerily predictable results. The most drastic effect has been the militarization of police forces across the nation, and the intimidating presence of soldiers in airports and train stations. Over time, the American people have accepted their subordination to this systematic expression of state omnipotence and violence. They've been pacified. Police departments nationwide are given gee-whiz gadgets developed by the military, like the Stingray Cell Site Simulator and the IMSI Catcher. Such surveillance technologies chip away at our Fourth Amendment right to privacy. They're often deployed in secret, and cops who use them are compelled to sign non-disclosure agreements with the FBI. Such gadgets are used to identify every person at a Black Lives Matter demonstration or meetings to boycott Israel. Many cops have military experience. They return from overseas duty and still consider themselves heroes protecting the empire. Then the FBI or CIA comes along and recruits them into the secret boys' club, and they think they're above the law. They're perfectly willing to use the same extra-legal tactics they learned in the colonies on dissidents at home. Their sensibilities are informed by the crimes they participated in overseas. In the colonies, they got to bust into the homes of Iraqi and Afghan civilians, guns blazing. When they return and become cops, they automatically know who to target: the poor, blacks, leftists, environmentalists, and anti-war activists who disrespect their sacrifices on behalf of the nation. Political cadres own and control cops in America like they own and control special policemen in occupied countries. A favorite gee-whiz gadget they dispense is PredPol software for predictive policing. PredPol was designed for tracking insurgents and forecasting casualties in Iraq and was financed by the Pentagon. One of the company's advisors, Harsh Patel, used to work for InQtel, the CIA's venture capital firm. If, for instance, the software depends on historical crime data from a racially biased police force, then it's just going to send a flood of officers into the very same neighborhoods they've always over-policed. And if that happens, of course, more personnel will find more crime, and presto, you have the potential for a perfect feedback loop of prejudice, arrests, and high-tech success. To understand what that means, keep in mind that without a computer in sight, nearly four times as many blacks as whites are arrested for marijuana possession, even though usage among the two groups is about the same. I'll expand on the CIA, FBI, Pentagon infiltration of law enforcement in the next chapter. Meanwhile, let's address one more problem with Lawler's official biography, which states that the general's military service began in 1967. After service in Vietnam from 1971 to 1973, he received a direct commission in 1974 as an intelligence officer. Again, the information is intentionally misleading, with no mention that Lawler was a CIA officer. In fact, the unsuspecting reader is led to believe he was in the military. Might Lawler have consented to this subterfuge because he was still serving the CIA undercover as a military officer when he took the job at Homeland Security? Bruce Lawler in Vietnam. I first read about Lawler in Everything We Had by Al Santoli. The interview was provocative, to say the least. In a section of his book titled The Phoenix, Santoli identified Lawler as having been a CIA case officer in one corps from November 1971 through December 1973. He quoted Lawler as saying that in order to win the war, what we had to do was get in and eliminate the ability of the VC to control or influence the people. That's what pacification was all about. The buzzword was root out. We tried to go in and neutralize their political structure. For anyone unfamiliar with Phoenix jargon, neutralize meant to assassinate, imprison, or turn someone into a defector or double agent. Political control, of course, is the name of the game. Lawler made some other provocative statements, including this zinger, which echoes my own conclusions about the CIA. We permitted the Vietnamese to corrupt the system, and we did it because we basically were corrupt ourselves. In an effort to find out how Lawler came to the conclusion that the CIA was corrupt, I wrote to him and requested an interview. He agreed, and what he told me confirmed everything Santoli had attributed to him, along with some additional startling details. Lawler told me that he joined the CIA, not the military, in 1967 while he was getting his BA at George Washington University. After he graduated, the CIA sent him to its training school. He took the paramilitary course in weapons and military tactics and was trained as an intelligence officer, the kind who manages interrogation centers and secret agents. After that, he was assigned to the Vietnam desk at Langley headquarters, where he received specialized training in agent operations in Vietnam. He also took a language course in Vietnamese. While at CIA headquarters, Lawler formed a rapport with the Vietnam desk officer, Al Seale, and when Seale was assigned as the base chief in Da Nang, he invited Lawler to go along. Lawler arrived in Saigon in November 1971 and joined the embassy's translation section. He transferred to Da Nang a few weeks later and was assigned to the CIA's counterintelligence office. He worked at that job through the Easter Offensive of 1972, during which time he developed a friendship with Patry Loomis, who would later achieve notoriety as an associate of Ed Wilson. In the summer of 1972, Loomis was made the region's PRU advisor. Just as a reminder, the CIA's PRU program was staffed by bloodthirsty mercenaries. Their job was to go into VC areas, in CIA jargon, to do unto them what they were doing to us. This is a reference to selective terrorism, the Viet Minh guerrilla tactic of murdering low-ranking colonial officials and collaborators who worked closely with the people, policemen, mailmen, teachers, etc. The murders were gruesome, a bullet in the belly or a grenade lobbed into a cafe, and were designed to achieve maximum publicity and demonstrate to the people the power of the nationalists to strike crippling blows against their oppressors. For the CIA, this tactic meant kidnapping, killing and mutilating political, i.e. civilian, cadres, along with their families and neighbors. When Loomis was promoted to head the PRU in Region 1, Lawler replaced him as the Quan Nam province officer in charge and liaison to the special police. In that capacity, Lawler did what Simmons had done in Fujian province. With his special branch counterpart, Captain Lam Min Son, he organized the most aggressive special branch officers into a special intelligence force unit that hunted members of the Viet Cong infrastructure in the hamlets and villages. Lam recognized that his own people could not run paramilitary operations in rural villages, Lawler explained. So we trained a unit of special branch guys, taught them infantry formations. They did this in anticipation of the pending ceasefire, at which point the PRU were to be placed under the control of Special Branch and integrated within Lam's Special Police paramilitary unit. Bored with filing reports, Lawler started going out on PRU operations with Loomis. He dressed in tiger fatigues and went on ambushes and traditional snuff-and-snatch operations. By then, the PRU had become, Lawler recalled, an adjunct duty of the special branch advisor in each province. The CIA funneled PRU salaries in one corps through the special branch to the region PRU commander, Major Vin, who then doled it out to the province PRU chiefs. In his congressional testimony in 1971, Colby described the PRU as special groups which were not included in the normal government structure. Since that time, this has been more and more integrated into the normal government structure and correspondingly conducted under the government's rules of behavior. In her article, The CIA's Hired Killers, Georgianne Geyer told how, in the absence of an American or South Vietnamese ideology, it was said in the early days, why not borrow the most workable tenets of the enemies? After all, she quoted Dan Ellsberg's friend Frank Scotton as saying, they stole the atomic bomb secrets and all from us. As a result, Geyer wrote, Scotton and a few other Americans started a counter-guerrilla movement in northern Quang Nai province. Terror and assassination were included in their bag of tricks. At one point, Scotton's parent agency, the U.S. Information Service, printed 50,000 leaflets showing sinister black eyes. These were left on bodies after assassination, or even, our terrorists are playful, nailed to doors to make people think they were marked for future efforts. But, Geyer said, whereas Scotton's original counter-guerrillas were both assassins in the night and goodwill organizers of the people, the PRUs are exclusively assassins in the night. Furthermore, she said, the PRUs are excellent torturers. Torture has now come to be so indiscriminately used that the VC warned their men to beware of any released prisoner if he has not been tortured. Sometimes we have to kill one suspect to get another to talk, Geyer quoted a CIA PRU advisor as saying. Another PRU advisor told her that he ate supper with his PRUs on the hearts and livers of their slain enemies. Another one said, I've been doing this for 22 years all over the world. He cited Egypt when Nasser was coming to power, and the Congo when we were trying to get rid of Tshombe. Geyer said about the PRU advisor, his job, like that of many Americans in South Vietnam, was terror. Geyer called American PRU advisors really the leaders, a view that contradicted Colby's claim that Americans were limited to advice and assistance. Things changed dramatically for Lawler after the ceasefire in January 1973. Prior to that, his easy striped pants job as special branch advisor amounted to coordinating with Captain Lam and getting reports from the Hoi An PIC. He had no dealings with the U.S. military or the province senior advisor and rarely acted on Phoenix information, just PRU and unilateral sources. There was little special branch input because no one talked to anyone. One big problem concerned the PRU. Although the PRU were placed under the jurisdiction of the special branch after the ceasefire, the CIA still controlled the purse strings. But it wasn't providing as much money as before and had lost control over the PRU leadership. According to Lawler, top-ranking PRU officers turned to graft, drug dealing, and shakedowns to make up the differential. Bad things started happening. Region 1 PRU Chief Vin began putting the arm on the Quang Nam PRU Chief Phan Van Liem, who in turn began changing money for the VC. Eventually, one member of the Kwan Nam PRU team went to Lawler and said, "It's getting out of hand." Ever the idealist, Lawler investigated. The investigation ended when he walked into the Hoi An PIC and saw that a woman, who knew about the region PRU chief's dirty dealings, had been raped and murdered. Her body was stretched over a table. "All of a sudden," Lawler told me, "Mr. Liem wants me to go on a one-way mission with him, and the other PRU guys are telling me, don't go." After the Easter Offensive of 1972, according to Lawler, the North Vietnamese Army concentrated on repairing its infiltration routes in preparation for the next offensive. Then came the ceasefire, at which point each village identified itself as controlled by the GVN or by the VC. As Lawler recalled, "All of a sudden, there was a lot of business, because as soon as someone put a VC flag on their roof, they're gone. Not in the sense that they were killed, but we could pick them up and interrogate them. And we basically were flooded." It was also after the ceasefire that the country club set took over. Tom Flores, a veteran of the CIA's Western Hemisphere Division, replaced Al Seal as the region officer in charge. Flores brought his own deputy and chief of operations, and the entire CIA contingent moved into the Da Nang Consulate under State Department cover. Their involvement in PIC and PRU operations was now thoroughly illegal. Lawler described Flores as a very senior officer on his last tour, whose objective was to live well, not rock the boat, and take advantage of the amenities that were readily available. That attitude was prevalent. Lawler, as an example, cited the public safety advisor to the field forces as one of the guys who used to set up the shakedowns of merchants. "He came out of that war wealthier than you or I will ever be, but you can't prove it." When Lawler brought the matter to the attention of his bosses, he was told, "Don't bother me," or asked, "What do you want me to do?" As with the Homeland Security boondoggle, many Americans went along for the profitable ride. The special branch liaison in Wei became the Tua Tien Province Observer, Lawler recalled. He had been a retired cop, and he liked the good life. But he had no enthusiasm. He thought it was a joke. He wanted to stay over there when his contract was up, so he became the Province Observer. He liaised. Contributing to the decline in morale after the ceasefire was the fact that the Special Intelligence Force units were disbanded and the PRU were placed under the National Police Command within the special branch. "This caused many problems," Lawler explained. "We started seeing more ghost soldiers, more extortion, and more protection money. We couldn't pay them at all, so we lost control." The PRU had the same mission as before and maintained their agents in field. But because the CIA advisor was no longer a participant, there were fewer operations and more excuses for not going. Lawler tried to maintain control by providing Gee Whiz gadgets like Nighthawk helicopters with miniguns and spotlights, and by being able to get wounded PRU into the hospital in Da Nang. Phoenix coordination, according to Lawler, was dead. There was nothing left. The Vietnamese gave it lip service, but there was no coordination with the special police. When the MSS and Special Branch got together, they tried to take away rather than share information. As soon as the Special Branch began paying PRU teams at province level, Major Vinh got concerned. Now he has to answer to Saigon. He has to give them a cut. That resulted in Vinh cheating somebody out of his cut, and that fractured what had been a unified unit. So it was that the PRU program devolved into a criminal enterprise, like Frankenstein's monster, beyond the control of its criminally insane creator. The last straw for Lawler occurred just before the end of his tour in November 1973. Having worked in Da Nang's counterintelligence office, he knew that an NVA spy ring existed in the area and that the special branch had sacrificed a number of low-level cadres instead of flushing out the most important spies. "It was a great deception operation," Lawler said. "The high-level people continued to operate." One of the NVA agents was the girlfriend of Tom Flores's operations chief. But when Lawler reported this to Flores, he did nothing but accuse Lawler of having gone native. Lawler then committed the cardinal sin. He defiled the sacred chain of command by slipping a copy of his report to the CIA station security chief in Saigon. The operations officer was sent home, but Lawler was finished. Security teams visited his office, confiscated his furniture, and presented him with a ticket back home. After that, I became disillusioned, Lawler confessed. He returned to Langley headquarters, where Ted Shackley, then chief of the Far East Division, accepted his resignation. Lawler was embittered. The agency betrayed us, he said. To go after the VCI, we had to believe it was okay. But we were too young to understand what happens when idealism cracks up against reality. We risked our lives to get information on the VCI, information we were told the president was going to read. Then guys who didn't care gave it to superiors more interested in booze and broads. Reprisal is the name of the Homeland Security game. But there's something weird about Lawler that keeps him coming back for more, despite whatever scruples he may have manifested above. After his bid to be the Democratic Party's nominee for Attorney General failed in 1984, Colby intervened and got him a job interview at Langley. He was interviewed by Rudy Enders, the chief of the CIA's Paramilitary Special Operations Division. However, despite his willingness to return to the fold and help do the CIA's dirty work in Central America, details of the Da Nang incident surfaced during the interview, and Lawler was not rehired, at least not officially. People look for vindication in different ways. Take, for example, the reaction of the militant right wing to America's humiliating defeat at the hands of the Vietnamese. Phoenix creator Nelson Brigham compared it to the frustration and bitterness of the German nation after the First World War. As we all know, that frustration and bitterness, plus the financial support of fascist sympathizers like Henry Ford, enabled Hitler to rise from the ashes of the Weimar Republic. The same thing happened in America after the preordained terror attacks of 9/11. Symbolically, 9/11 wiped the slate clean. All the moral prohibitions on the rabid right were lifted, and all the rage they had cultivated during the degenerate Clinton regime was unleashed under the aegis of counterterrorism on nations sitting on vast oil reserves, as well as suspected terrorists, domestic dissidents, and the flag-waving American public as well. Lawler, like Simmons, resembled a bitter man looking for revenge. They probably subscribed to the fascist theories of Michael Ledeen, who blamed the 9/11 terror attacks on Clinton for failing to properly organize our nation's security apparatus. Others blamed 9/11 on a conspiracy between the Mossad, Saudi Arabia, and those members of the Project for the New American Century who landed in the Bush regime's Office of Special Plans. But according to Ledeen, the problem was Clinton's sneering lack of respect for security. New times require new people with new standards, Ledeen asserted. The entire political world will understand it and applaud it, and it will give Office of Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge a chance to succeed and us to prevail. A lot of people with an axe to grind were jumping on the Homeland Security bandwagon, hoping to help Ridge succeed in crushing the left and paving the way for neocons to prevail. Knowing this, and fearing that Lawler was of the Ledeen reprisal persuasion, I tried to get an interview with him. I called his office and spoke with his secretary. She said he would call me back, but he never did. Knowing from personal experience that the macho men of the CIA never forget an insult, I was concerned for everyone who had fought to end the Vietnam War, as well as those who in 2002 were lining up to oppose the Bush regime's police state policies at home and imperialism abroad. So in 2002, I wrote my open letter in counterpunch to Bruce Lawler. Here it is. As far as I know, General Lawler, we still live in a democracy, although the Bush regime seems hell-bent on using the uninvestigated terror attacks of 11 September as a pretext to turn America into a military dictatorship. We are not yet, as far as I know, under martial law. Public officials like you still have a responsibility to respond to our concerns. Speaking on behalf of people concerned by the opportunity for the abuse of human rights and civil liberties presented by the corrupt Bush regime through its Homeland Security apparatus, here are the questions that need to be answered. 1. What happened in July 1995 to make you leave your law practice and go to the Army War College? Did the CIA have a role in that decision? 2. How did your education at the War College pave the way for your assignment as Special Assistant to the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, from June to October 1996, CIA officers often go by the term special assistant. Were you serving as the CIA's liaison to the Supreme Commander? 3. In May 1998, you became Deputy Director of Readiness and Mobilization within the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations and Plans. Your job was managing National Guard and Army Reserve units around the world. The job had international functions and fell under the CIA's cognizance. Did the CIA help you get this job? How were you involved with the CIA in this position? 4. You were the first commander of the Joint Task Force Civil Support. Your job was to work with civilians. Was this a CIA assignment? Did you liaise with the CIA? Was this assignment based in any way on your experience as a CIA officer in Vietnam? And was your main qualification the Phoenix sensibility that you brought to the job? What are your other qualifications? 5. In a 24 March 2000 statement to Congress, you seem to be preparing for the Homeland Security job you have now. In a way, you even predicted the calamitous events of 9/11. Did you in fact have any foreknowledge of those attacks? 6. In your statement, you said that as commander of the JTF-CS, you created civil support teams, CSTs, to assist in case of a weapon of mass destruction incident. The CSTs, you said, were National Guard assets and thus can function under state or federal authority. They are equipped with sophisticated communications systems that will enable local first responders to talk with neighboring jurisdictions or link up with federal centers of expertise. CSTs are also being equipped with state-of-the-art detection equipment that will enable them to help local first responders quickly identify potential WMD agents. That's what you told Congress. Would you now please tell us what role the CIA plays in CST operations? It sounds like a great CIA cover to me. Is there a civil support team near me? Will you allow me to observe how it functions? 7. What is your relationship with the CIA in your role as Senior Director for Protection and Prevention at the Office of Homeland Security? What do you do? Is it true that the Office of Homeland Security will be the strategy-making part of the apparatus and that the forthcoming Department of Homeland Security will be the tactical and operational part? What is the function of the Homeland Security Council, and what is your relationship with it? Can we have organization charts of these entities, including ones that show where the CIA is hiding its covert assets? 8. Last but not least, please explain the conspicuous absence of any reference to your CIA background in your official biographies. This seems to suggest that you are still CIA. Are you? And tell us, please, if you and others like you intend to use your power to seek revenge against your ideological opponents. Bruce Lawler never responded, but then I hadn't expected him to. The point of the admittedly rhetorical open letter was not just to expose the CIA connection and its ramifications, but to broadcast this possibility of revenge and hopefully thereby forestall it. Red squads and red herrings. Where the CIA is involved, there are always trap doors and deadly deceptions. Recall Operation Twofold and how the CIA hid a hit squad within the DEA's internal security unit. The CIA does nothing unless it can be assured of plausible deniability, and the Homeland Security apparatus is an infinitely large space in which the CIA can hide operations aimed at manipulating society and managing the political control of the American people. Twofold isn't the only example of the hidden dangers of such a setup. In its 1970 end-of-year report, the Phoenix Directorate quoted from a captured VC circular titled, On the Establishment of the Enemy's Fung Hong Intelligence Organization in Villages. The VC circular was referring to the fact that the CIA had instructed each special branch case officer to organize and maintain 10 People's Intelligence Organization, PIO, cells. Each cell consisted of 3 agents in a hamlet. Apart from fingering VCI, the PIO agents engaged in Psy War to jeopardize the prestige of the revolutionary families, create dissension between them and the people, and destroy the people's confidence in the revolution. PIO agents also made lists of the VCI cadres to be murdered when the ceasefire took place. Their prescribed criteria are to kill 5 cadres in each village in order to change the balance between enemy and friendly forces in the village, the circular said. In doing so, the primary task of GVN village chiefs was to assign Phoenix Intelligence Organization and Security Assistance to develop and take charge of the People's Self-Defense Force and select a number of tyrants in this force to activate invisible armed teams, which are composed of 3 to 6 well-trained members each. These teams are to assassinate our Viet Cong civilian infrastructure key cadre, as in Vinh Long province. Throughout this book, I've given examples of how the CIA uses civic actions as a cover for invisible armed teams aimed at political enemies. Ensuring deniability is the first step, and to that end, Phoenix employed the motto, "Protecting the people from terrorism," to present itself as goodness and light. And yet the CIA was inserting secret hit teams inside the self-defense force that were ostensibly protecting the people from terrorism in order to kill, without trial and based on all the flawed sources we have discussed, those whom they presumed might be aiding the Viet Cong in some way. People who were civilians and had rights as such. It is exactly this type of duplicity that informs the Homeland Security apparatus. The DHS has even adopted the Phoenix motto, protecting the people from terrorism, and for the same exculpatory purposes. The big question is, will these security forces conduct Phoenix-style paramilitary and Psywar operations against dissident Americans in a crisis? Consider Bruce Lawler. He reported the rape and murder of a woman at the PIC, and when nothing happened, went about his business. Rob Simmons spent 18 months inside a PIC and never saw anything inappropriate. Bob Kerry, as will be discussed in a forthcoming chapter, led a team of Navy SEALs into a Vietnamese village and murdered its men, women, and children. They did these things, came home, uttered the magic words God and country, and all was forgiven. What have they proven but their intense commitment to kill? And as a result, they have again been inducted into the gang of the protected few and can get away with murder, like cops killing blacks. They crossed the line and lost perspective. Lawler was aware that CIA officers systematically corrupt entire societies and in the process become corrupt. He even admitted it. Yet he still desired to take his place among the protected few. Why? Was it the chance to get revenge? But paradoxically, on whom? The brother of Frank Scotton's mentor, Dick Noon, manipulated the dreams of a peaceful tribe of people in Malaysia for the purpose of turning them into a police unit noted for its ruthless slaughter of captured communist guerrillas. Scotton did the same thing to mountain tribes in Vietnam. Americans' dreams are being shaped, too. Hollywood producers make billions extolling the violent virtues of the ruling warrior class. Video games make killing and mutilating Muslims a consummation every young American man desires. It makes them feel powerful and provides an antidote to their social alienation. The CIA shapes our dreams of democracy by controlling the information we receive. The Senate's 6,000-page report on CIA torture was whittled down to a 525-page summary with redactions. The summary, nonetheless, told how CIA officials tortured more suspects than acknowledged and in more gruesome fashion than imagined, misled Congress and the media, and jerry-rigged the program for deniability. It said that torture served no purpose other than making CIA officers feel good. We aren't allowed to know the details and the names of the victims. The evidence is concealed, and no CIA officers were indicted. But at least we know why CIA officers commit crimes. They do it because they like it, and it is how they become rich and powerful and protected. John Kiriakou, the CIA officer who revealed waterboarding in 2007, was one of 2 CIA officers sent to prison for the Empire's post-9/11 crime spree. His crime was telling the truth. His conviction and imprisonment was a blunt warning to other CIA officers. In the underworld of organized CIA crime, omerta is the only law that matters. Epilogue. Why be concerned with button men like Lawler and Simmons when mafia generals like George H.W. Bush are giving the orders? As DCI, Bush laid the groundwork for the off-the-shelf counter-terror network that facilitated the enterprise and the illegal selling of arms to Iran to finance the illegal Contra war in Nicaragua. He laid the basis for the global Phoenix program. As lame duck president in December 1992, Bush invaded Panama and killed hundreds of innocent people in order to kidnap former CIA asset Manuel Noriega, and he pardoned six loyal Republican officials involved in the Iran-Contra scandal in one of the greatest criminal cover-ups in history. As David Johnston said in the New York Times, Bush swept away one conviction, three guilty pleas, and two pending cases, virtually decapitating what was left of Iran-Contra prosecutor Walsh's effort, which began in 1986. He added that there was evidence of a conspiracy among the highest-ranking Reagan administration officials to lie to Congress and the American public. Bush's idiot son W. honored the family tradition of mass murder by launching the illegal war on Iraq and the global war on terror with all its horrors. Like his father, he is venerated among the ultras who profited as a result of his militancy and disdain for international law. Bruce Lawler wasn't quite that powerful, but he was influential at a decisive moment. According to the Washington Post, his boss at Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, delegated most tasks to him. The Post described Lawler as having alienated many people in the White House and in the department with a brusque and secretive manner. Perhaps Lawler was secretive because he was a CIA agent. When he left in 2003, the Post described the six-month-old Department of Homeland Security as hobbled by money woes, disorganization, turf battles, and unsteady support from the White House, and has made only halting progress toward its goals, according to administration officials and independent experts. The Post blamed Lawler for the problems, saying he at times helped lead Ridge in the wrong direction and was involved in perhaps the most bitter dispute in the department's short history. Lawler had reviewed and approved an agreement that Ridge signed with Attorney General John Ashcroft that made the Justice Department, not the DHS, the lead agency investigating the financing of terrorism. The memo enraged the Secret Service, which was required to halt hundreds of probes and forego its tradition of financial investigations. Ridge apologized, but the rift took months to heal. As a result of Lawler's actions, real power remains centered in Bush's 50-member Homeland Security Council, which is ruled by the CIA. Jerry-rigged like Phoenix, DHS lacked a political infrastructure at the top of the department. The department's roles and missions are still being defined, one official said. Lawler won't say if he accomplished his mission, stated and unstated, or even what it was. My guess is that his job was to keep the organization off balance so the CIA could step into the vacuum and assert control in its formative stage. In any event, Lawler stayed in Washington and became a Beltway bandit, capitalizing on his contacts to serve on various security-related boards and academic posts, including the Homeland Security Advisory Council. He achieved his personal ambitions, but at what price? How the DHS advanced secret CIA missions is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 17. Homeland Security. The Phoenix comes home to roost. In the articles I wrote about Homeland Security between 2001 and 2003, I said that America has been in an ideological state of siege since 9/11, when the Twin Towers came crashing down, and all the moral and psychological prohibitions on the ultra-conservatives were lifted forever. All the anger and frustration they had nurtured during the Vietnam War and the Carter and Clinton administrations was unleashed in a torrent of warmongering. The anthrax-challenged Democrats climbed on the war wagon. On 15 September 2001, Congress, save for one glorious dissenter, gave Bush $40 billion and the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force against those who could be said to have been involved in what would remain largely uninvestigated terrorist attacks. Bush embarked on his holy crusade against Islam, but directed at Afghanistan and Iraq, not at Saudi Arabia, where his family's business partners and the majority of those officially blamed for the 9/11 attacks came from. To protect this misadventure into neocolonialism in the Middle East, Bush, on 8 October 2001, signed into law the Office of Homeland Security to detect, prevent, and recover from terrorist attacks and/or weapons of mass destruction attacks on American soil. The Homeland Security juggernaut was born. Less than 3 weeks later, again with overwhelming congressional support, Bush signed the Patriot Act, vastly expanding the government's domestic intelligence gathering and law enforcement powers, while rolling back individual rights and protections from government intrusions. The stigma of public accusations of his having stolen the 2000 election was replaced with a popular war of revenge against Afghanistan. Bush's approval ratings doubled in polls. In the absence of political opposition, the Bush regime's rationale for neocolonial aggression was set in stone in September 2002 with the promulgation of the National Security Strategy of the United States. Through this manifesto, the national security establishment effectively conferred upon itself the divine right to launch murderous, preemptive attacks on any Muslim nation with valuable natural resources. Russia and China were long-range strategic targets. A first-degree murder strategy may make many Americans feel safer because U.S. terror is directed at the Islamic other, but there are hidden clauses in the manifesto's fine print. As an exercise in neocolonialism disguised as protecting the American people, the eternal war on terror constantly recreates the urgent need for its existence, and by destroying the lives and livelihoods of millions of innocent people, it automatically fuels more terrorism, though within the United States itself, terror attacks are few and far between, and most of what passes for terrorism derives from FBI incitement and entrapment. Of 508 defendants prosecuted in federal terrorism-related cases in the decade after 9/11, 243 were involved with an FBI informant, while 158 were the targets of sting operations. This is to say nothing of what many people regard as false flag operations. Moreover, neocolonialism constantly fuels political dissent within the United States. There are, after all, enlightened Americans who recoil in horror at their government's aggression. But increased dissent is what the national security establishment wants. You can call it a vicious cycle or a self-fulfilled prophecy, but dissent provides the ruling elite with the pretext it needs to impose the repressive measures required to maintain and expand its political dominance. It's a win-win for the capitalists, insofar as a police state delivers a wide range of economic benefits to those who invest in its requirements.